Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Belva Davis, host of KQED's Friday night program this week in Northern California. You can find us on the web at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure now to introduce our distinguished speaker, Taylor Branch, journalist and author of a landmark trilogy on Martin Luther King, Jr. The latest release is At Canaan's Edge. Taylor Branch is a Southerner, a native of Atlanta, Georgia, who professed to have been apolitical in his teen years, but that his life was changed upon viewing the brutality against civil rights demonstrators in Birmingham, Alabama. He majored in American history at the University of North Carolina and went on to study politics, religion, and philosophy at Princeton. He has been on the front lines himself against the war in Vietnam and in the campaign for Eugene McCarthy in 1968. He continues to write today for the Washington Monthly, where he's had a long association, and he has written for Harper's and Esquire magazine, as well as a number of other books. The first volume of his trilogy on the life of Dr. King, Parting the Waters, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction and the Pulitzer for History. So welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Belva.
Mr. Branch, you are unveiling Canaan's Edge in a world that's, I think, light years apart from 1989 when you first brought us Parting of the Waters. How have the ways that we communicate today, that is, the multiplicity of sources of information, changed our perception of truth and non-truth, good and evil? And evil to me, I will interpret as being discrimination. How would you interpret the, I guess, the mood of the land, the mood of your audience, its differences from the way they might have received the information that you gave us in that first volume some years back?
Wow, that's quite a first question. I'm discovering that, you know, because I'm just out on the road after 8 years of being a hermit. Then I get kind of thrown into space to find out what questions are asked at audiences and who shows up. And I do think that you're correct that things change. My books take so long, there's a new generation each time. For Parting the Waters, there seemed to be a hunger, only 20 years after the 60s, almost a hunger and nostalgia to try to sort it out. And for the second book, I expected that to continue, and it wasn't there. There was another generation that was a little more jaded in 1998. And now I'm out, and I don't really know. I know my computers are obsolete by the time I finish the book. Things have changed so drastically. I still think that there is the most signal fact about our age is the attenuation of language in public discourse. I'm always asked, you know, what would Dr. King think if he were to blink back into existence? And I don't know. But I do think that certainly there are many things that are shockingly different if you remember that the country was still segregated even in public at the time. If he turned on the TV to watch a college basketball game in Memphis at the time he was killed, it would be all white college basketball players in 1968. So the idea of a world changed to the degree that it has, and no Soviet Union, no apartheid, South Africa, those things would be shocking, but I think the big shocking disappointment would be the way we speak in our public discourse. The movement wrestled with the elements of democracy and the obligations of citizenship and the relationship between the races every day at a very basic level. They were all kind of citizen scholars, whether they were kids or preachers or whoever was involved, and that's what makes it such an amazing period to study. Nowadays, it seems to me we are our public discourse has atrophied. And that it is a sadness that at a time when we have so many blessings and so many examples of great empirical change that our language offers so much less hope about dealing with the remaining problems that we tend to want to avoid. That it is, I think Dr. King would be pretty sad about that, that the movement offered so much hope at a time when lynchings were still common, when the world was stratified in ways that we take for granted, that we've forgotten, and we don't offer that kind of hope today. And I think that's because we don't take citizenship seriously as they did, and our public discourse and our media are dominated by spitballs instead of debate.
You talk about language, and of course, you know, that's your tool of communication here. And I talked about the diversity of the way that we communicate. Is there any way that you see a Martin Luther King rising to the level that he did in terms of our interests in what he was trying to do in an environment like this?
Oh, I think that it's possible. Your question is about the media, that the media is so divided that perhaps it would become harder to be a social phenomenon at the level that he was. I mean, it just seems to me that the basic fact is that King became a phenomenon because he spoke for a social movement. Nobody expected a social movement after World War II in conditions when people were really struggling over what freedom means. That's a good condition for America. What does freedom mean? That's what our history has been defined since the beginning. In the Cold War, having won World War II, but still being segregated, what does freedom mean? Nobody would have predicted that the next great social movement would have arisen out of the Southern Black Church. And that if it had arisen out of the Southern Black Church, that the signal issue would be the seating arrangements on buses. Mm-hmm. So that's what created the movement, and it was serendipity. And what made King such an amazing leader, aside from his politics, which the political skills are later, was that he framed an issue like the seating arrangements on the bus in the very fundamentals of not only democracy, but of religion, that he was so sturdy in his appeal to make this issue, to frame this issue as one of both equal votes and equal souls, and to draw, to me, one of the most amazing things about Martin Luther King. He had enemies all over the place. We were never as comfortable with him as we'd like to remember in nostalgically. He was speaking about religion and politics every day, and yet I cannot find on the entire historical record any of his critics, supercilious or heartfelt segregationists or enemies, ever criticizing him for mixing church and state. Now, that is a remarkable phenomenon, and the reason is, I believe, because of the way he did it. He did it in such an ecumenical way that he was drawing on spiritual and political, patriotic, fundamental roots in such a way that it didn't offend anybody. And he was not. Most people get in trouble for mixing church and state because their real agenda is they're trying to subdue one or the other. And, you know, they want to kick God out of politics, they want to subordinate all politics to some particular dogmatic notion of religion. King never even aroused the suspicion of that because he was so gifted in talking and framing issues of discrimination and race in the most hateful empirical conditions, but he would put them in such a universal language. And we don't have that now, but I think basically that if a citizens' movement occurred first, and that's the question, how many people are percolating around on citizenship issues not knowing which one is going to take root? Nobody can predict the next bus boycott. Nobody. I don't know whether it's going to be over capital punishment or over global warming or over violence or over Guantanamo, the way we're disgracing ourselves with the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo. Who knows? All of these things. If you get around, people are going to argue about all of them. You never know. But if you're really agitating over what democracy means and something that and taking chances that it might mean that to other people as well, taking leaps, asking questions. It can take fire again. These things tend to be cyclical. I believe there will be new citizens movement, and it may be harder for in today's media environment. It's never going to be like it was before. But I believe that a spokesperson will arise. I have no idea whether it will be a preacher, a black preacher, a woman, a man, or who. But I think the gift that King first showed was to speak for a citizens' movement by putting it in a universal language that resonated far beyond the confines of any particular group.
We'll come back to that future leadership in a minute, but I now should return to the book.
Okay.
Let's have you describe to us the mood of one county in Alabama that seemed pivotal to those years of 65 to 68. Can you talk to us about what was going on in Alabama and how Dr. King's life intersected with it?
I presume you're talking about Lowndes County.
Yeah, Lowndes County. Mm-hmm.
Lowndes County is the county between Selma and Montgomery. It's a big, rural, frightening Klan county. No black person was on record as voting in the entire 20th century, even though they were 70% of the population. It's one of the most feudal places I've ever been to try to record the history. The book opens basically in a scene because the Klan has gotten wind by virtue of penetrating the local black culture that one of the itinerant preachers, it's so rural they don't have any regular resident preachers, everybody is a jackleg who comes through, that he's going to mention the voting rights movement in Selma when he comes to preach in Lowndes County. And the Klan says, if he does that, we will kill him. And they actually show up at the church, the local Klanspeople, and say, send the preacher out. And this preacher, they manage to scurry him out safely and out of the county. He's never been back to Lowndes County since, even though he's been elected to public office and lived in Selma. He was so terrified by the Klan that day. But he went running right into a mass meeting in Selma and said he had been run out of Lowndes County. The county was that fearful. It's the county where Viola Liuzzo was killed on the last night of the final Selma march. He was bushwhacked on the highway by a group of Klansmen that included a longtime FBI informant. J. Edgar Hoover managed to cover up the fact that the FBI informant had asked for permission from the FBI to go on the murder party and was granted that permission, which would have been a radioactive fact if it had ever come out. And he covered it up in part by telling the President of the United States and others that the victim was a heroin addict when she wasn't, and that she was snuggled up to a black man in the front seat, that essentially she deserved to be killed, smuggled over that. Jonathan Daniels, one of the seminarian who came down in response, one of the many people who came down in response to the Selma beating on Pettus Bridge, where the book also opens, was murdered in public in Lowndes County. It was really rough. And it's really a vehicle not only for a lot of the people to talk about, a lot of the people who tried to register to vote for the first time and what a citizens' movement looked like at its most primitive stage there, but it's also where Stokely Carmichael went the day after the march was over. He had already had breakdowns and mental breakdowns after 5 years in nonviolence, going to jail. He went in there by himself, risked his life every day, lived out in a shack, was pursued by the Klan, created what, in my view, is one of the great miracles of citizenship organizing. In 1 year, he took this county from where people were scared even to think about going to the courthouse. Nobody would do it. To registering more than half of the black voters and having them in all these workshops, not only talk about voting, but talk about having some of them run for the offices. What do these offices do? What does the county coroner do? What does the sheriff do? What does the tax assessor do? What does the probate judge do? And they ran essentially as they wanted to run for the local offices. And they had a big debate because Alabama at that time, the Democratic Party, you had to have an official party symbol because there were a lot of illiterate voters. And under law, the party symbol of the Democratic Party was a white rooster with a banner over it saying white supremacy for the right. They didn't want to run on that. They wanted to run for local offices, and Stokely sent his SNCC volunteers to Atlanta to... They had a debate, and these are all sharecroppers, basically. They said that they wanted their symbol to be something that chased roosters. And they wanted a farm animal that would chase roosters, and they sent Stokely and his SNCC people to Atlanta to find an emblem of a cat, because they said cats chase chickens in the yard on our farms. And they went to Atlanta University, and they found the football mascot symbol for the Clark College Panthers, part of the Atlanta University. They traced it, brought it back to Alabama, used it on the ballot. They voted in 1966, the first time any of these people had ever voted in their lives. We have photographs of that, thank God for some movement newspaper people who took pictures of them. The FBI said that if they tried to vote in a church, that the church would be burned, that the Klan was determined that they not vote, that they couldn't be protected. They voted outdoors instead, around little cardboard tables. They're mostly sharecropper women in print dresses. The New York Times attacked this process because they weren't voting in the Democratic primary, said it was sabotage of democracy, that these people didn't appreciate the vote. It's one of the saddest editorials I've ever read in the New York Times. They represent the culture, and when they're wrong, they're spectacularly wrong. They scorned this whole effort and scorned Stokely by name. Anyway, they did this voting. To me, it was a miracle. Stokely Carmichael basically said he had had enough, that he couldn't be nonviolent anymore, that he couldn't stay nonviolent in a country that expected only black people to be nonviolent. He kept saying, why is it that America admires nonviolence only in black people? And finally had enough, and within 4 weeks of this vote in Lowndes County, he became elected chairman of SNCC, proclaimed black power, and publicly renounced nonviolence, voting, and democracy itself in speeches in the Stokely that has become famous. Said that they were all tricks against black people because the enormous efforts to do patriotic duty through the nonviolent movement were not appreciated, and their blessings were too hard to understand, and the burdens of nonviolence, particularly in a poisonous climate of the Vietnam War, were pretty hard for a 25-year-old person to cling to. So Stokely left, came to California, made some speeches about what had happened in Lowndes County, and inspired the Black Panther Party here to take the symbol from the rural elections that had occurred in Lowndes County. And, of course, the Lowndes County, Alabama, became the rationale for and the impetus for the Oakland, Huey Newton and the Oakland Black Panther Party the next year. So you here in the Bay Area are indebted to Lowndes County for an incandescent part of your history, whatever you want to make of it. The man who ran from the church, the man who rescued the preacher who ran for the church was elected sheriff of Lowndes County 2 years later, became the probate judge. It's still one of the poorest counties in America. But there's no terror there. Black people hold most of about half of the county offices, and it's an enormous transformation in citizenship. It's really like going from the 14th century to the 20th century in one county in the power of this movement. So Lowndes County is one of the through stories from start to finish.
And no, and we didn't even look. This is I was just going to go over and pick up your book for the audience on radio who cannot see it. It's 776 pages, followed by another 200 and some, I think, of notes and references. If there's anything you want to know and you want to trace the factuality of it, this is the book for you.
Oh, I don't want Oprah.
I have more yellow tabs in this book than any book I've ever owned, I think. I think it's the most documented book, I understand, that's been written to this.
Well, I didn't want Oprah to think it was fiction. So I put a lot of footnotes in there.
No doubt about it. But I, in all of it, you know, I would pick it up because, like everybody, we all have busy lives, and it's not big print. But you found you couldn't put it down because you were meeting new heroes every day in these preachers and their wives, and you did talk about the women. Can you talk a little bit about those Southern women who stood with the men in spite of this Klan's threat and the brutality of it?
Well, the women were the pretty much the leaders in all the movements as long as there wasn't a microphone around. As soon as the microphone came out, the women disappeared. In fact, I have a photograph in there of Rosa Parks speaking. And this was done last year before Rosa and Coretta died. She was the only female speaker at the march at the end of the Selma to Montgomery march, and she wasn't planned. She wasn't on the program. It was all male speakers, microphone, all male. And the reason that she got to speak was because she had been elbowed out of the march 3 or 4 times by people who didn't recognize her. They didn't know who Rosa Parks was. These are mostly kids. And they elbowed her out of the march, and finally she was fussing about it and complaining, and somebody recognized her, and they made it up to her by having her come up and speak a few remarks there under the Capitol. And the photograph of her speaking there, and what the photograph is wonderful. It doesn't look like Granny Rosa Parks. It's quite a moment. Basically, in all the Lowndes County SNCC office had a Freedom House with an outhouse and a sagging roof. It was 5 women and Stokely, basically, and Bob Mann. So there were a couple of guys, and the movement really. Well, I have a rule in history that I think progressive movements in American history from start to finish require a combination of prophetic voices of justice and the sensibilities of women. And when you have those two in harness, you're going to make progress. And certainly the movement was one of those. Pauli Murray was one of my big heroes in here. Mm-hmm. She is not very well known. She was turned down by my university, the University of North Carolina, in a letter that said, "We don't accept students of your race." She was turned down by Harvard Law School in an official letter that said, "We don't accept students of your sex." She became a lawyer anyway, and she filed a lawsuit in Lowndes County after Jonathan Daniels was murdered and the Klansman who did it in broad daylight was acquitted. Pauli filed a lawsuit challenging not only were there no black people on the jury, but there were no females on the jury. And the reason there was no females is that under Alabama law, females could not serve on any juries. Petty juries, grand juries, civil juries, anywhere. And this wasn't just true in Alabama. This was true in 2 other states. And in 30 other states, the right of women to serve on juries was severely restricted. Prevailing Supreme Court decision was Hoyt v. Florida, which upheld a Florida law saying that if you were a female and you wanted to serve on a jury in Florida, you had to go down to the courthouse affirmatively and sign an affidavit attesting that you wanted to be considered and that it would not interfere with your homemaking duties. This country was really stratified to a degree that every parent should not take for granted every parent of a daughter. Pauli Murray filed suit against this. It was called White v. Crook, and it became a constitutional suit that overturned the exclusion of females from juries in Alabama and then swept through the rest of the states so that we have now what we take for granted of equal citizenship. The movement started people struggling over the issues of equality and what equal citizenship meant in race but far beyond race. And Pauli is a wonderful example because not only did she do this for women there, but later in her 60s, she decided that it was wrong that women were excluded from the clergy. And she went to seminary and became a pioneer at the age of 66 in the first group of female, a black woman, in the first group of female Episcopal priests ordained in 1976. there was almost a schism within the Episcopal Church because the male clergy said the Bible reserves authority in religion to males, very much like what's going on in the Episcopal Church today with gays. But this is only 30 years ago, and we've jumped this far forward. So Pauli Murray is one of many, many pioneer women here that show the radiant influence of the civil rights movement from race out into other areas that have democratized this country, make the civil rights movement a model for a democratizing force that we should have paid much more attention to before we went into Iraq. I dedicated the book to Diane Nash as another model because she had been such a she's a student leader from Chicago who expanded the notion of the word movement four or five historic different times. Selma was her idea. She wrote it out. It's a plan. It was her answer to the Birmingham church bombing in 1963 when the four little girls were killed. She wrote it out as a plan saying essentially these crimes couldn't be sloughed off in Alabama if black people could vote in Alabama, and it was a plan to kind of paralyze Alabama with a nonviolent army until it granted the right of black people to vote. But Diane, like many of these other people, is so underappreciated as a historical character. Her husband, James Bevel, left her. They had one of the most tempestuous, unlikely marriages you'll ever see. Dr. King used to say of Bevel that he was like a Hebrew prophet himself and that it's the cracked ones that let the light in. That you need these people in the nonviolent movement, but it was a huge burden for Diane, who was left to raise her children by herself and has been basically ignored by history, and to some degree, in the dedication, wanted to try to make that up to her. She's one of many.
We should return to our main character, and that is Dr. King. But you can see, if you read this book, there are so many historical gaps that we were missing until you researched all these and verified the validity of our admiration for many people that are listed there. But let's talk about Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. in 1965. We'll start there, and or at whatever point you would like to pick up.
Well, I think it's fair to start there. I mean, that's where the book starts in Selma. Basically, Diane goaded King to go to Selma because the Birmingham church bombing 63, and they don't go until the Nobel Prize. This was over the unanimous objection of his staff, who, because he'd just gotten the Nobel Prize at the end of 1964. Most of his staff wanted to celebrate in chicken dinners and accept awards for a couple of decades before doing anything else. And King, in what to me was part of his more amazing, what I call the downward king, the conscience-driven king, said, "We've been to the mountaintop with the Nobel Prize, but the valley calls us," and he dragged his staff down to Selma to fulfill Diane's work on her plan. Bevel used to say that Diane would pester you the way the leeches pestered Humphrey Bogart in The African Queen when he got down in the river. And he said that's what she did to Dr. King to get him to go to Selma. So he goes there, and he's in jail within weeks of getting the Nobel Peace Prize over the right to vote plan. So it starts there. And to me, and he struggled there, and he went to jail there, and he was about to give up, and somebody was killed. Jimmie Lee Jackson was killed, which precipitated the plan. Again, Bevel's idea to march from Selma to Montgomery as a last gasp thing to present this petition to George Wallace. And it was that first day that on the first attempt to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge when the 600 all-black marchers, mostly from Selma, some from the surrounding counties, were violently repressed by sheriff's deputies, state troopers, and Klan possemen with these clubs that had barbed wire wrapped around them and with tear gas and horses. And news footage of that was shown on TV that night. King, in one of his amazing examples of leadership that's often, it's a detail. That night he sent out an appeal, that very night, to people around them, to basically to his giant Rolodex, mostly of clergy, but also of volunteers and people who had been helping the movement, asking them not to send a contribution or to petition or for them to elect a new president or do something down the road, but asking them to come to Selma, not for a summer convention, but tomorrow. He asked them to come the next day. Please be in Selma tomorrow.
That was one of the most fascinating passages, the Tuesday March. I don't think we know a lot about it.
That's
and the
right.
decision that King had to make at a pivotal point. Can you talk about that?
Yes,
the
that's
Tuesday
the political
March?
Side of King. I've talked about the oratorical, the prophetic, all that. But between and these people came from everywhere, nuns from St. Louis, seminarians from Cambridge, rabbis from Chicago, Unitarians from Los Angeles, you know, people...
Bishop Pike from San Francisco.
Bishop Pike. People came from everywhere on a day's notice to risk their lives because they knew that this was, you know, violent. They came, but in the meantime, the federal government is galvanized by the fact that these pictures are going all around the world. And they got an injunction from a federal judge saying, let's hold a hearing on whether or not this march should be protected, should it happen. The Governor Wallace of Alabama wants there to be no marches. That's the reason he repressed this march, and so on and so forth. So they're under an injunction, and John Doerr, a wonderful civil servant, is there begging Dr. King, obey this injunction, because if you do, and we have this hearing, then we can come and support your ultimate goal, which is the Voting Rights Act. But if you violate a federal court order, there's no way the federal government can go forward with this law. But at the meantime, people who have advised him against having the first march because it was too dangerous and people will get hurt have now flip-flopped. These are the student leaders and are now saying, let's march hell or high water. You've got these people. We don't care if we get slaughtered or not. So let's go. We've got 1,000 people who've come in. And he goes, he stays up all night, people argue, which is basically the pattern for the whole book. It's a crucible, you know, all day and then all night, arguing over what to do. And they march the next day, they get the injunction, the Justice Department guys are out there on the phone, straight to the Justice Department, which is on the phone to the White House, are they going to obey the injunction or not? They go across the bridge, a little farther than where they were beaten, and at that point, the troopers are there again, and this time, instead of coming forward to beat them, Governor Wallace orders the troopers to, because he knows that they've got a federal injunction and he thinks he can trap King, he orders the troopers to back away. And like the Red Sea parted, and all of a sudden the way to Montgomery is open. And King has about 20 seconds to decide what to do. Do I go forward and say, whoopee, this is going to be great. We've made them back down. The way is open. We can now march all the way to Montgomery, at least until we realize that we're out here in the middle of Klan country with nothing but a bottle of water. And how are we going to march 50 miles through there and survive? And what are we going to do when the judge holds us in contempt for violating this order? So he goes forward a little bit and then says, we will return to the church. And they all march back, and it's called the Turnaround March. And SNCC people, the student leaders, by the time they're in the turnaround thing, realize that they've turned around, and they're mad. They also think they could have hijacked the whole march. If they just stood up and said, no, let's go forward, that they could have taken the march. And they started singing, ain't gonna let nobody turn us around, as a sign of sarcasm, because they have turned around. But lots of the ministers and the preachers and the rabbis and the nuns are crying because they're so relieved. And they take the song seriously and are very inspired by it. So this is what the movement is. But Dr. King had to make a split-second decision. Many people never trusted him again and called him a sellout because he turned around there. Other people, and I believe wiser people in the long run view, say that this decision preserved the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which changed the partisan structure of politics in the United States to our time.
Let's talk about the FBI and King, the FBI and almost anybody you want to talk about. They were certainly very active in that period.
The FBI was a dual organization during this period. Nobody even then went into the FBI wanting to sit around with earphones on, copying down telephone recordings or listening to bugs. It's a pretty dreary and dull and to some degree embarrassing function. But they wanted to solve crimes, and they were solving the very first civil rights murders were solved by the FBI right in this period. The Vernon Dahmer case, the Viola Liuzzo case, in spite of the fact of what happened there, they the informant. So agents on the ground are fighting within a politicized FBI to solve crimes, but the higher up you go in the FBI, the more politicized it is, and the more Hoover is only interested in using fear to rule and to make people and to scare people into granting him arbitrary authority. If that sounds familiar today, it's because he didn't invent this technique. He was just better at it than most people. But we still have a problem of the political use of the FBI that is not interested in public service whatsoever. I mean, one emblematic way of that sign of that was he had a written rule that applied only to Martin Luther King, that when threats came in, death threats came into him, the normal FBI procedure was to provide notice to the target of a death threat. With King alone, he said, never tell Martin Luther King that of any threat to him, because we don't want him to think that the FBI serves him and his ilk. Yeah, they use that kind of word. So it was highly political. Yet Diane Nash told me once when I was fussing about the FBI and what it was doing to students, because so much of it was all on plain paper stationery with orders, let this not be traceable, do not do anything to cause embarrassment to the FBI. It was kind of surreptitious, scurrily, propaganda-type thing. But they were sending out threats. They called Stokely Carmichael's mother and said people were coming to kill him, to scare him. They drove him out of the country. I was talking to Diane about this, and she waved it off. She said, don't talk to me about Hoover. Hoover's our fault. And I said, what do you mean Hoover is your fault? You know, you're in the movement. You're a victim of Hoover. And she says, I know, but we left him in a position of arbitrary authority for 50 years, and the American people got exactly what they deserved. And he stayed there because we let him stay there. And I include black people in that, even though black people couldn't vote. And to me, Diane was giving an example there, saying, she said, anybody who studied even 1 week of American civics would know you don't leave anybody in a position of secret authority like that. And the first part of being a citizens movement, the first part of saying I'm going to stay up all night and write a plan to answer the Birmingham church bombing, not that I'm going to bitch about it or yell or scream or blame somebody else, is to take being a citizen seriously, to say if we own an equal piece of this country with the President of the United States, the first thing we have to do is to act like it, and everything that's wrong with this country is my fault. That's a remarkable attitude on the part of, I mean, the first thing I know about Diane Nash was that she was in Chicago competing in the Miss America contest in 1956, performing Take Back Your Mink from Guys and Dolls. And there was a rumor that she didn't win the district contest because people thought she was passing for white. She was a very light-skinned black person. She then goes to Fisk. This is a remarkable life's history about somebody who was a victim of the FBI, took citizenship seriously, and yet had one of the most unique perspectives on the FBI and its continuous use of political corruption that, of course, obviously is still there to this day.
Let me remind people that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. It's a radio program with author and journalist Taylor Branch, who is describing the life and times of Martin Luther King Jr. from his new book on Cannon's Edge. Some questions from the audience, and we'll get back to. I have so many of my own, but let me be a little bit fair. How would you describe the relationship, if any, between Dr. King and Thurgood Marshall? Did they have one?
They had one, but it was pretty. It was pretty tense. Thurgood said that Dr. King was a boy on a man's errand. during the bus boycott. You know, he was steeped in the NAACP legal strategy, and he thought basically demonstrations and nonviolent tactics were troublemakers. So they weren't even peers, because Marshall was of a different generation, but they were common leaders from rival wings of the movement. And I think there was it would be a stretch to say that there was a lot of I know there was respect there, but there certainly wasn't any warmth.
What would you say were Martin Luther King's greatest strengths and his greatest weakness?
Well, his greatest strength was his ability to have not only his balance, I think, come from that balanced message when he's being buffeted around, but even his sense of humor, a wonderful sense of humor in the crucible of so much opposition and so much loneliness for his message of nonviolence, certainly toward the end of his career. People said, argued about two things for his greatest weakness. Number one, that he couldn't fire anybody, that he didn't have a temp, that he was too tolerant of misbehavior among people who were his loyal lieutenants, and that therefore he allowed discipline to seep out of the movement. His answer was always, in a nonviolent movement, you have to have extra leeway for people who are risking their lives, and it's hard to fire somebody who's willing to march out in the line of fire. So other than that he was too tolerant, I think people thought that his other greatest weakness was that he didn't explain his tactical choices very well in public. He never explained himself as a political leader. He always was a prophet in public and never a politician. Other people said that the role of prophet and politician don't mix very well, that he was privately making political choices, but in public he was always a prophet, offering up a larger movement. I don't know whether that was a weakness or not, but that was certainly what people around him said. You know, explain why you're coming out against the Vietnam, why you're doing the Poor People's Campaign at the end of your life, which everybody was against, and not consolidating the movement in the South or going against Vietnam as various other people wanted to do. So people felt that he didn't explain his political choices very well in public.
Another question. In reading your book, as I said, there are many stories there. There's an interwoven history of American Jews and American blacks. It was fascinating, this part of the story, for me. How did this partnership start, and when did it fray?
Well, we have to put it in context. The civil rights movement involved only a tiny fraction of black people. And a tiny fraction of Jews, but they were disproportionately obviously involved Jewish people. I think that it started all the way from the beginning. I mean, we have to recognize that Jewish intellectuals drove a large part of the intellectual dialogue about idealism and utopia and freedom in politics from the time they arrived in the diaspora in the great waves of immigration in the 19th century forward. They were a lot of the intellectual ferment about socialism, about utopianism, idealism, social justice, right up until one of the great turning points in American history, the Six-Day War. And you see in the book, Stanley Levison, King's devoted Jewish advisor, saying this is a turning point in history, because the anti-war movement is losing Jews because the Six-Day War has turned half of us into hawks, and ever since then, a lot of the progressive drive for social justice has lost some of the Jewish intellectual voices who have been diverted into the neoconservative movement, which is relying more on force and becoming more comfortable with the White House because of the great shock of the Six-Day War and the discovery that the Army of Israel defeated five nations at once in 6 days. And all of a sudden, David is reborn, and that becomes the arm of refuge. And it's affected American social discourse to a degree that I don't think is often acknowledged. But I do think that the friction between black people and Jews is overestimated. I think that it's more of a leadership phenomenon in these intellectual circles, particularly since the Six-Day War, than it is something that you see in a lot of synagogues. There's antagonism on both sides, but there's also still, I think basically, it's fairer to say that there's been a retreat from interracial dialogue that's affected lots of groups, even blacks and Jews, because the traditions of social justice and measuring social justice by interactions across racial boundaries and religious boundaries is still part of the Jewish tradition. But this is a very sensitive and difficult topic. The influence of the Six-Day War and its impact on the ideological and intellectual ferment on social justice issues, diverting it away from nonviolence into issues of national security and that sort of thing, and reinforcing what had already started inside the civil rights movement across the board from right to left, which was a retreat from nonviolence as a social force, or as something that people talked about and thought about, is a very, very significant development.
Another question. What do you say to young people, and this is like my daughter, who's about King's enormous contributions, but questions his leadership because of his supposed womanizing?
Well, I say that it offers an enormous opportunity for those of us to do everything that he did and then more if we don't have those weaknesses. This is not a new phenomenon. Very few people during King's career attacked him head on and said, "I reject what you stand for." They said, "That's very interesting, Dr. King, but," and a long series of buts, "but you shouldn't break the law, but you shouldn't use children in your demonstrations, you shouldn't meddle in foreign policy, you shouldn't engage in civil disobedience," so on and so forth. And people would find some way to dodge or sidestep the political and the moral challenge of the message that King was offering in the public square. We have to remember the private life stuff was not an issue when he was alive. It's been a posthumous issue growing out of the discovery of the FBI surveillance in the 1970s. So it's been more in our time that it has become the latest and perhaps the most salacious and heavily used of the dodge techniques. Well, I would pay attention to Martin Luther King if only he didn't have any girlfriends. But since he did, I don't have to pay any attention to it. And you simply have to say, you know, we're not going to tear down the Jefferson Memorial, and we shouldn't tear down the example of Martin Luther King either, because he was a human being. In some respects, it's quite interesting. I think there's a lot of evidence that King essentially he preached openly about his own demons and about the fact that he couldn't give all of this up. Almost as a way of acknowledging that it was part of his public motivation to take risks in the movement to redeem his private failings. If that's true, I mean, people surely shouldn't be glib about the relationship between the public and the private person. There's pretty good evidence in some respects that that King was driven, in effect, to make up in public by public sacrifice for what he saw as his private failings. So I just try to tell people not to try to dodge that, not to try to deny it, but don't let it obliviate for you the political challenge of one of the great figures of the 20th century.
have a question from Commonwealth Club member up in Reno, Nevada. Said, you know infinitely more about Martin Luther King, he says, than I do, and most of us, of course. And so we're down to the outcome of the King work. What do you think he would say? What would be his thoughts about Supreme Court appointments of Clarence Thomas and the appointment of Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice to be Secretary of Defense today, he says, by a Yale Republican? What do you think that he would think about these people, their opportunities in light of the sacrifices of those who he walked with?
Oh, I don't know. That's too hypothetical. You know, he basically, look, he never expected people to all be out of the same ideological cloth. I think that he would have cheered the opportunity and, you know, said these people have taken these places and that'll make it easier for the next person to take these places of all different kinds. So I don't know that he would have gotten, I'm not saying how he would have recommended that these things be confirmed or not, but I think that he would have been thrilled about the career of Colin Powell.
One more reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program with author and journalist Taylor Branch, who's discussing the life of Martin Luther King and the era 1965 to 1968. You do spend a lot of time talking with us about the Vietnam War, the intertwinings, King's decisions around that. This is a question that says, how do you respond to uncalled for criticism that you spend too much time on King's opposition to Vietnam?
Well, I think it's uncalled for. No. No, you know, to me, this is one of the reasons that the 60s are still so confusing. We tend to separate. You write a book about Vietnam or you write a book about civil rights. To me, they're not just two stories that happen at the same time. I mean, uncannily at the same time. That literally within hours of the beating on Pettus Bridge on March 7th, the first Marine combat units landed in Da Nang, Vietnam. And I put in the very first photograph page has the marchers leaving, Rabbi Heschel and Dr. King leaving in Selma with Hawaiian leis around their neck, because some of the many people who went down there were Hawaiians who brought them leis, saying, we're finally going to make this march, and if we die, we die happy, and this is a great triumph. And when the soldiers landed in Vietnam, the Marines landed, there were Vietnamese girls there waiting, and they put leis around their neck. And that's the other photograph. So these are two hopeful stepping-off moments. One at the beginning of the Vietnam War, one at the beginning of the Selma March, one testing the capacity of nonviolence to promote democratic change at home, and the other testing the capacity of violence by enormous force of arms to promote and protect what was defined as freedom in Vietnam. These are two parts of the same story. The whole issue, and one of the great untended issues in the American academy and in American politics and everywhere, is violence, the relative capacity of violence and nonviolence to advance democracy and to be strong and to protect democratic values. King says that to the end of his life, he said that the long-run strength of democracy grows against the grain of violence, that democracy is nonviolence. That's what a vote is. But most of us tend to think that when you're really in a pinch, you need Mel Gibson or the Marines, and that's long-range strength. And King says that's fool's gold, and there ought to be at least a debate about that. This is in some respects, the most urgent issue of our time.
Can you talk about Dr. King's his history? How did he become such a strong and loyal supporter or center his life around this business of nonviolence?
Wow. Well, I think that he centered his life around nonviolence because it came out of that sturdiness I was talking about in his oratory, one foot in the patriotism and one foot in the scripture, is that underneath, this is a lot of his communion with Abraham Heschel. Heschel thought that the underpinnings of democracy were in the Hebrew prophets. Their idea of equal souls, that we all have equal souls before God, is the underpinning of the idea that we all should have equal votes. And that King had this notion of, equal souls, equal votes, one foot in, the promise of democracy, the other in the scriptures, and he thought what united them and made them, gave them such resonance and communion as kindred ideas, was nonviolence. That democracy is nonviolence, and that the revolutionary attitudes of democracy, that is, that you can be self-governing, which James Madison said is going to be the measure of democracy, whether it'll survive. Nobody is more self-governing than somebody who's willing to die but not to kill for their ideals and to be beaten. And so nonviolent demonstrators were a quintessential attitude that's essential to democracy through nonviolence. And of course he felt that nonviolence is the key to the spiritual hope for justice and love in that tradition. And obviously the much neglected heart of our religious tradition, and that it's to him such a scandal that religious people so easily discarded their beliefs in loving your enemy and non-resistance to evil and non-violence as the core teaching of Christianity and Jewish justice theory, so that religious people, he used to say, sadly, are against all wars except the one we're in. And so this for Dr. King, he saw nonviolence, that democracy and religion and spirit had common roots, equal souls, equal votes, and beneath both of them was nonviolence. So to him, nonviolence, this is what made him speak about it time and time again toward the end of his career, is that even when it was being repudiated by the rest of the world, he saw nonviolence as what had set the positive institutional change in motion that was going to benefit, as he said, not just black Southerners liberated from segregation, but white Southerners and foreigners and immigrants and women and gay groups, and everybody who's been liberated by the notion of inclusion and not violence of the spirit or flesh against them. So he sees nonviolence as really underlying our most basic principles in ways that we're too often blind to.
Just want to add a bit. I got a question a while back saying what were King's connections to San Francisco. Well, one of them was to a theologian who started the first interracial, interdenominational church in America, Dr. Howard Thurman, who wrote a book called Jesus and the Disinherited that King is supposed to have carried with him through many of his battles, and who was a professor at Howard and in Boston and had great influence on him in planning this idea of nonviolence as a way to accomplish goals. Just that bit from San Francisco.
Absolutely. And in fact, he at times wanted to go up and take over that the chapel at Boston University where
yes.
Howard Thurman had been. He was much moved by him, yes.
Right. We didn't get to Lyndon Johnson, and he's very much a part of the action of that era. This person says, for all of his faults, Lyndon Johnson had the courage to make hard social decisions. Why is this type of coverage lacking in our current political leadership?
Oh.
We can take another hour for that one.
Because I don't think that our current leadership is as steeped in the potential of what government can do in public service or of what the vote, how dear the vote is, and what an instrument it can be for social justice, as Lyndon Johnson was. And that makes it a tragedy that we have political conventions today and his own party can't even mention his name. But that's because we're still at sea about what the 60s meant. We don't understand how much we're indebted to, and we take for granted. People haven't been able to tell the story of how much we've gotten from that period, some of which we owe to Lyndon Johnson. We're never going to be able to square our politics and our language with our history unless we're able to confront the glory and the tragedy of Lyndon Johnson as a great Democratic leader who, with his eyes open, went into Vietnam anyway. And that's why he probably is the second most important character in this story to me.
Mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson's would you consider the decisions? We know what he made the day of the second march, that was a pragmatic
right.
decision. When do you think he really became convinced that this movement, if he was going to change Vietnam or anything else, he had to also deal with civil rights at the same time.
You mean deal with Vietnam at the same time? Well, he spoke against Vietnam right from the beginning, and then Johnson convinced him that he, Johnson, was going to settle the war and to mute his criticism into 66. And King regretted that because he said by 1966 that the climate of the country was poisoned by the war and against the movement, and all he had done was to mute his conscience. And so he had a big debate about changing that and gave this pivotal speech at Riverside Church one year to the day before he was killed. That speech was almost universally condemned. By everybody, for him meddling, him not supporting the war, that really was one of the saddest moments of his life.
We've heard a lot about Coretta Scott King in these last few days. Tell us what you can about the relationship of the Kings.
Of the Kings. Mm-hmm. Well, she resented the fact that he made her stay home. He was a chauvinist in some respects. And he's out on the road and old-fashioned, although Septima Clark and some of the women are scolding him, saying this movement's going to liberate women too, and you better hope that that you wake up before they're liberated. He valued Coretta for her dignity and the role that she played at a time when people's dignity was under assault every day under segregation. He also valued her for what I would regard as her underestimated quality, which was that she had a very, very powerful understanding of nonviolence across the board that she had had even before she met Dr. King, and that led her to apply it with his full approval. This is part of their unity together, to issues beyond race, to war and to poverty, and particularly to issues of war and peace. Coretta led marches. I have a photograph in here. I didn't know she was going to die either, but a photograph of her pressed against the White House gates with a peace petition, with Dr. King not even there. So I think that her breadth of understanding of nonviolence is not really very well appreciated or understood.
Mm-hmm. Just a few seconds left. Do you think there's anything that could galvanize people today the way King was able to do so?
Well, I think it takes a citizens' movement to galvanize leaders like King, that the movement comes first, and that the movement, you never know where it's going to come from. People percolating around on different issues. People think of the 50s as a dead time, and it wasn't dead because people were percolating on every kind of issue there was, and nobody predicted it was going to come to fruition over the issue of seating on a bus. We have the same thing today, and I think when there is a citizens' movement, a leader will arise that can put it into the large framework that King did. They're very rare, but the first thing we have to recognize is that they're created by the citizens' movement. They don't call it into being out of ex cathedra.
Our thanks to you, Taylor Branch, journalist, good storyteller, and author of the landmark trilogy on Martin Luther King Jr., including At Canaan's Edge, for his comments today. We also want to thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Belva Davis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.